Welcome to the Health and Self-Care Podcast. My name's Dr. Andrew Tresidda, a Somerset doctor, and I'm joined by my friend and colleague,
Dr. Kate Staveley, a GP from Somerset.
And we're really pleased today to welcome Lee Reed. Lee, we're going to be talking about race, ethnicity, and mental health. I've been practicing that, but it's a tongue twister for me. Race, ethnicity, and mental health. Lee, tell us a bit about yourself, please, and then we'll move on to the topic, if we may.
Okay, thanks, Andrew. So, yeah, my name's Lee. I'm the Equality, Diversity, and Inclusion Lead for NHS Somerset Integrated Care Board. So that trips off the tongue quite nicely. So my role is predominantly looking at patients and specifically minority groups and underrepresented patient groups to understand why they're not accessing our services or previous experience of accessing them and so on. And then working with our commissioners and our providers to see how we can kind of iron out some of the issues people have raised in terms of services. Sometimes they are genuine concerns. Sometimes they're more perceived discrimination and things like that. It's an interesting job. And I get to work with all manner of people, including people from ethnic minority groups.
That's really interesting. Thank you. And one of the things I do is I'm under the Mental Health Act, I'm approved under Section 12 as a doctor with special expertise in assessing under the Mental Health Act. And so Mental Health Act assessments, they are an opportunity for somebody who is deemed to be at risk of their own health or their own safety and maybe a danger to others. So they are either found in a public place, in which case they can be detained under Section 136 of the Mental Health Act to a place of safety, or they may already be an informal or other patient. And I've seen an awful lot of Mental Health Act assessments over the years. Tell me, are there any particular problems, Lee, with race and ethnicity?
I think it's kind of taken a step back from that even. I think... The way that people access mental health services is very different when you look at the different ethnicities. So you have, if you look at Asian populations, they are very underrepresented in mental health services. And that's kind of then interpreted by mental health services that the need's quite low. And actually, it's probably self-exclusion that's going on there. With Black people, it tends to be because of criminal justice or something like that. So they're almost forced into mental health services. So I think that's probably why, when you look at the figures in terms of detentions under the Mental Health Act, Black people fare very, very badly. I think it's the stats are in 100,000 population. And I think it's about 340 per 100,000 population that are Black, and white, it's something like 70.
So how does that compare to their representation in the general public
in terms of population numbers?
Yeah,
so obviously black people are a minority ethnic, so that could almost push that number even further up.
So a larger proportion of Black people are running into difficulties around the mental health services, is that right?
Yeah, and I get the sense that it tends to be Section 136 detentions by the police. So the police will pick them up and drop them off at Yeovil or wherever the other one is. Is there still one in Wales? I can't remember.
Taunton.
Right. Thank you. So that tends to be how majority Black men, as well, I would say, enter into mental health services, is through police intervention.
So help me to understand what would be happening to trigger that. Would these be people who are experiencing mental health difficulties, or are these people who are criminals and then people are questioning whether it's a mental health difficulty?
I think that there is, and we'll probably talk about bias a little bit later, but I think there is bias, that there's an assumption that Black people are more likely to be drug abusers. So that assumption is there, whether it's true or not, of that individual. So again, under the MHA, people might be detained because they're seen as a risk to themselves through their behaviours. I don't think that's true. I don't have any stats. No. I don't think that Black people are more
So the feeling is if a black person was behaving a bit oddly, they'd be assumed to be a criminal. If a white person was behaving a bit oddly, it would be not taken quite so seriously, perhaps.
Yeah, well, they probably had too many ciders or something.
I'm not going to challenge that at all, but can I just take a different perspective or another perspective on that, in that traditionally, and this is using stereotypes, and I hope you don't mind me using some slight stereotypes because I was born in the 1950s, so please forgive me that. But a woman in distress often will be tearful and attract sympathy, whereas male distress often actually exhibits as aggression, as alcohol, as getting drunk, or outward behavior, which can often end up in the criminal justice system.
You're right, and I think as well that sort of looking at intersectionality a little bit, when you think of black men and black women are quite often perceived to be problematic and angry, whereas black men are perceived to be aggressive, which again it isn't necessarily the case. You know, you have aggressive men, you have aggressive women, you have problematic men, you have problematic women, irrespective of their backgrounds in terms of ethnicity. So I think there are a lot of assumptions, and I'm going to use the word bias again, where we expect people to behave in a certain way, whether that's based on previous experience or what we see on telly or whatever, and we assume that somebody is going to behave in a certain way, which is why, again, with black men, restraint is a lot higher in mental health services for black men, because they're seen as stronger and more able to overpower white men or black women. I think a lot of that does stem from bias rather than perhaps how they are behaving. Might not be what's actually driving those decisions to use things like restraint.
And certainly when you look at women's health problems, that image that black women are a problem results in poorer care for black women. It's, you know, more women die in childbirth in the black community than they do in other ethnic communities. So that bias is incredibly important when we're looking at how we look after people, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that, I don't know if you've heard of it, it's on the Harvard website, that there's an implicit bias test that you can do online. It's free. It's fascinating. It doesn't actually ask you really directly questions. It tests it's like word association with color and negative and positive. And it gives you a little report at the end to say whether you have implicit bias towards black people, towards white people, and so on. I'd encourage anyone to do it. It's really interesting. It probably could be quite challenging, because it might come back telling you something that you're not really very comfortable with, because I don't think most of us sit here and think I'm a racist. I think particularly what's going on at the moment, we see that. But most people, I think, may have racial bias, but it's not.
I think all people have bias, and that can be related to race or other characteristics.
Absolutely.
That depends on your previous experience. And I think I read somewhere that one of the most important things is to acknowledge your bias, and to not say I'm not biased, I'm in favor of, to say no, I am biased, and I acknowledge that this is what I'm doing to try and counter it.
Yeah, and in a previous life I used to do training on unconscious bias, and it was very much about the recognition. It's not criticizing you for having it, because it's quite natural, and it, you know, it all links into the fight and flight, doesn't it? Of, you know, you have to make a snap decision the minute you see somebody, and you will base that on the color of their skin or their gender or however they're presented,
their height, or whether they've got one arm, depending on what your previous experience.
They're dressed and all sorts of things. And so it's about acknowledging, as you say, Kate, it's about acknowledging that you have this bias, but how do you react to it? And you know, a lot of the stuff I used to teach was, you know, if you always read a particular newspaper because it agrees with you, try reading one that's like a right-wing paper rather than left-wing or vice versa, you know, and just challenge yourself with different messages. You might disagree with what you're reading, and that's fine, but it's challenging you to think in a different way and look at things through a different lens. And I think that's really important, that we do challenge ourselves on our biases and acknowledge that we have them, and because if you don't acknowledge it, you're just going to live by them.
The most difficult ones to acknowledge are the ones that we're so unconscious about that we don't even realize. As the philosopher fish said to the student fish, consider this ocean that we're all swimming in. And the student fish said, what ocean? So we have deep biases, prejudices sometimes, and misunderstandings that are personal but maybe cultural. If we treat life as learning, then we may have a chance of seeing them. But if we are entrenched in our own position, and I say nothing about social media other than that it may sometimes act as an echo chamber to entrench people in their positions, as opposed to the wise advice that you just gave us, which was to look at different points of view, then we may have a problem.
And I love this fact checker that BBC have launched. I think that's amazing. When they follow up their programs with the fact checker, and it just, you know, because you get a particular politician of a particular party talking on there, and then they fact check it at the end, and it's like, that's really useful, because you're not having to go off and do it yourself. You know, they're providing that for you, and I do like that. I think that's a real positive, again, to maybe address some biases as well, that just because you agree with that politician doesn't mean he's actually right, it just agrees with you. So, yeah, and I think going back to your point, Kate, around women's health, I think a lot of the time there is self-exclusion. I think you were talking about the black women choosing not to go into health settings because, and therefore getting a poorer outcome. I think just moving on to a different ethnicity altogether, to look at travellers, for example, who are an ethnic group under the Equality Act, the self-exclusion for mental health there is so multi-layered, and I'm going to generalize now, it's quite a patriarchal society, so traveler men are very, very unlikely to acknowledge that they're struggling with their mental health, and quite often, because I go onto sites quite a lot, be those unauthorized encampments or permanent sites. And it's usually the wives that come and speak to me about their husbands and say, I'm a bit worried about my husband, but he won't go. There's no point getting to talking therapies or anything like that, because the view is that the cultural competency isn't there to understand a traveling lifestyle. So how on earth can that clinician or whoever's working with that individual possibly understand what impacts there are on my life because of my lifestyle? So there's a lot of self-exclusion. We did come up with a bit of a way around it a little while back, and that there are a couple of traveler-led mental health services. They're national rather than Somerset, and I've got some little credit card things now. On one side it's got printed on there, one called Away, which is run by travelers for travelers, self-referral. You don't have to go through GP or any other clinician. And then on the other side, a bit more specific, there's the Travellers Pride, which provide mental health support to LGBT travellers. So we've got these cards, and when the wife says to me, oh, I'm a bit worried about them, but they won't go into that, she hides it in the glove box of their van in the hope that one day they'll be in LA by when they're out working and they'll find it and maybe just make that call.
So there's a lot to be said for these peer support for mental health difficulties. You see it in the farming community. It's been really good to hear Adam Peaty openly discussing his mental health difficulties, and suddenly the whole of the sporting industry are now much more aware of mental health difficulties. So it's good, isn't it, that they're supporting themselves. But I think the medical profession need to get on board as well and understand what's happening, don't they?
Yeah, and I think as well with I'm talking now specifically about the more mobile travellers, so not people that live in bricks and mortar and or on permanent sites, but, you know, they tend to be in a place for probably little more than a week most of the time. So if you're trying to enroll on a 6-week CBT course, that's just not going to work, because you're going to be in Devon tomorrow and then Cornwall the following week. So how on earth do those more long-term interventions work for travellers? And they just don't, and they don't engage with them.
interesting challenge. Coming back to what we were saying about race, ethnicity, and mental health, mm-hmm. you mentioned that Asian are less likely to call. I have worked for a number of years for NHS Practitioner Health, who look after doctors specifically with mental health issues. And very interesting, in their 15-year review, currently they're very busy with 6,000 registrations a year. White British, 65%, Asian or Asian British, 23%, mixed, 4%, Black or Black British, 3%, other ethnic groups, 3%. So actually, and the gender split is 72% female and 27% male. Mm-hmm. So quite interesting that in that area that people are coming forwards. Asian and Asian British, but maybe not in the general population. I have to confess. So I grew up in Somerset. We're talking from Somerset today. The three of us are white. There is a danger of us being white privileged. And I have to say that Somerset is probably not as diverse as many areas in the country. And certainly in my growing up time, it was very undiverse at all. Although within our services, within the hospitals, we're privileged to have many, many people from around the world who come and help, who come and work here and make their homes here and who live here.
Indeed, and just picking up on the your comment there, Andrew, I think that whole white privilege conversation is very uncomfortable for a lot of people, and I think as someone who has white privilege, I absolutely accept that I do. It's what I do with that. You know, don't use it to further my own benefit. I quite often talk about the suffragettes, and I'm not taking away, women did all the legwork there, absolutely all of it, but it took men with white privilege to actually vote, because women didn't have the vote. So you had to get people with that privilege to further your campaign almost. And I think that's a really good example. Yes, they did all the work, and I'm not taking anything away from the suffragette movement, but ultimately it took white men to agree it. And I think that's a good example of how privilege can be used, and that kind of leads into allyship as well. I'm a big, big fan of allyship. And, you know, I can be in a space that perhaps a black person wouldn't be comfortable being in and speaking up. So why don't I use that privilege in those spaces to support the efforts of others? And I think it's really important that I just want to make it really clear there that it's not about speaking for people. Absolutely not. It's about speaking with or encouraging people into those spaces to speak for themselves. But I do think privilege, whilst it's an uncomfortable thing, I think people feel like you're accusing them of something, when actually it's just something to acknowledge and to use for good.
Very interesting. And that actually feeds into, if we look at it, into the transactional analysis of parent, adult, child, and the polarized positions of rescuer, persecutor, victim, because it is very easy to see somebody who is white and privileged like myself as in a power position, and therefore to feel victim to that if it's widespread in society. Mm-hmm. Whereas actually, I love what you say about speaking with people, not for, because it's actually about us all treating each other with respect, and understanding the other person's point of view and trying to do our best for each other.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, as I said at the start of this, I work with lots of patient groups, some more confident to self-advocate than others. And I think it is about going on that journey with somebody. So if I do everything for them, if I phone their GP to book an appointment, if I go to the pharmacy for them or take them here or fill out this form or do whatever for them, that's not empowering them to do it themselves. So it's that negotiation, I think. So I'd much rather show someone how to get onto a website and fill a form in than actually do it for them. But there will be occasions where people are like, I can't, if you don't do it, I'm not doing it. In which case, it's kind of okay then to maybe be a bit more of the rescuer in the, in that kind of triangle. But that's with agreement. It's, I think, when people take it upon themselves, thinking, "Oh, you don't need to worry. Come here, I'll sort it all out for you."
It's that white savior complex, isn't it? That we need to avoid, and we need to avoid assuming. And this applies to all people. It doesn't matter if it's a different race, ethnicity, lives down the street, and yeah, everybody. We should not assume that we know what they're thinking and what they need and what they feel. We should listen to them and hear what they're saying.
It's examples, isn't it, Kate, where you hear of someone who's visually impaired and someone very helpfully crosses them over the road when they weren't wanting to cross the road at all, but they've just assumed that they need help getting over the road. You know.
Then you get the opposite effect, which is nobody will help them across the road because they're frightened that they'll be told they're doing the wrong thing. And actually, you can just go and say, "Oh, do you want to cross the road? Would you like me to help you?" And I was at a festival recently, and there was somebody stuck with their mobility scooter on a lump of grass. And everyone was walking past and sort of looking and going, "Oh, poor man." And I just went up and said, "Would you like shove? Or are you all right?" And he went, "No, I really like shove. Thank you." So I just shoved him off the loop of grass and went off. But everybody else was just walking past, assuming that they were going to get told off but trying to help. So it's a very narrow path to walk, isn't it?
You carry on. I've got a story to follow on with that. Carry on.
No, I was just going to say, I know we're sort of going off of ethnicity here, but you know, when you look at disability, I remember in my previous job, the amount of times our recruitment team would come up to me and say, "Oh, we've got somebody who's starting who's blind. What do we need to do?" And I'm like, "Well, have you asked them? Or am I allowed to?" Well, you're not telling them something they don't know. They're not going to go, "Oh, that's why I keep bumping into stuff. Thank you for telling me." And it's that fear, I think, of acknowledging a disability in that example, that you're almost going to be upsetting or offending. But actually, if you're doing it for the right reasons, I have no issue with mentioning something like that.
And then don't get offended if they say no, thank you.
Adult, equal power relationship rather than making assumptions. It's the assumptions that cause us problems. And just picking up what you were saying a moment ago, Kate, there's the story, one of Aesop's fables from a couple of centuries ago, the pompous English gentleman in a top hat who's walking alongside a river and sees a teenage boy who has got into considerable difficulties in the rapid water. And he says, "You stupid boy, you shouldn't be swimming there. It's such a dangerous place." At which the boy calls back, "Please, sir, can you rescue me first and tell me off afterwards?"
So, Lee, what should we be doing then to support people who are trying to access mental health services with different differences?
I think a lot of it does come down, for me, it comes down to, I mentioned it earlier, the cultural competency side of things. And it's about not making those assumptions. I don't expect everyone in every hospital to be an expert on every nationality and so on. But it's about having a general understanding. If you look at language, for example, you know, the terms we use in mental health services, if English is your second or other language, you might not be familiar. Your language may not have had a term for it. I was listening to something the other day, actually, and I think it was one of the languages from Afghanistan, and they don't have a word for, was it depression or mental health, one or the other. And they've got this whole beautiful poetic phrase to describe it, something about a leaf floating held up only by the wind or something. And that's how they view depression, you know, and with the traveling community as well, which I was talking about a second ago. Mental health is pretty meaningless, that term. You know, we band it around all day long, don't we, in health services. But, you know, that they still refer to terms which probably to us seem a little bit maybe old-fashioned. So, "Oh, is her nerves playing up?" Or, you know, she's a bit jittery or something like that. And that's their kind of active vocabulary for terms that we would probably refer to as mental health. And they'll look at you and go, "Don't know what you're on about." So I think just even simple little things like acknowledging the language the patient is using and reflecting it is just something really simple to aid that communication. And particularly when you're talking about mental health, you know, a lot of it is around speaking and sharing, isn't it? And so I think language is even more important when you're looking at that sort of relationship with health. And just not making those assumptions. So again, going back to the bias, I think, you know, just to sit back and let the patient maybe give you a bit of a steer. And I'm not suggesting put all of the onus on them to educate you, but, you know, just take their word for it. You know, if they tell you, I'm not really comfortable with that because then that's fine. You know, we're not here to argue, well, you're in Britain now, so why are you doing that? You know, and just being mindful of just the cultural differences.
We started with a title that included the phrase mental health, and I'm just reminded that until 6 or 7 years ago, the phrase mental health was virtually unknown except among commissioners who were commissioning services across a county or a locality, whereas now it's become a phrase, I think, that means not just mental illness, not just anxiety, depression and psychosis and other issues, but actually it's used sort of casually by many of us when we're emotionally upset, maybe on a short-term basis. And so it's become a catch-all phrase. I don't know if you want to tease out any aspects of that, Lee, and then perhaps Kate.
Well, I think probably linked to that I remember I did, it wasn't scientific at all, but I sent an email out because I'm conscious that when we talk about physical health, it's seen as a positive. And when we talk about mental health, it's seen as negative. So I just sent out an email to work colleagues just saying, give me one word in response to physical health and mental health. Everything physical came back as healthy, gym, you know, all these really positive things. And all the mental health ones came back as depression, anxiety, suicide. And it was so striking that all we've changed is one word, you know, physical to mental. And suddenly it's just a negative thing where actually you can have positive mental health. You know, we can all have good mental health.
Mental and physical health are inexorably linked, and you can't have one without the other. And we're increasingly, the more we talk about mental health, the more we try to send it off into its own little subdivision. And we say, oh, we must include mental health, and we push it further and further away the more we try and include it. And you know, all health involves mental health. And I think emotional regulation, as you were saying, Andrew, it's so important for us to recognize it's okay to be sad sometimes. That's not your mental health. That's a normal physical response to something bad that's happened. I always used to say to my patients who came in who were feeling depressed, I'd say, do you think you're depressed for a reason? Is there a reason for you to be feeling the way you're feeling? Or is it just coming from inside you? And I always found that rather refreshing because they go, oh, well, no, because my husband's left me in the church. Or they'd go, well, no, because my life's wonderful and yet I still feel really, really sad. So it's quite interesting.
That's nicely teasing out endogenous as against a reactive depression, which is so important. Back in Hippocrates' time, there was a doctor whose name I have forgotten, who is quoted as saying, the problem with doctors these days is that they look only at the physical, not at the emotional and mental person as well. But as you so rightly say, Kate, we are a whole being where the two are inextricably linked. Let's all meet together.
Indeed we are. But yeah, I think just reminded me, Kate, when you were talking there, that I was watching something the other day and there was an Asian, South Asian lady who was giving a TED talk, I think it was. And it was really interesting because she went to her GP because she was experiencing low mood. And her GP was also South Asian and wouldn't sign her off for 2 weeks because she felt it would affect her career because of her race. And she kind of understood what the impacts might be. So talked her into other things rather than signing off, you know, not saying GPs sign them off, you know, willy-nilly, but no. You know, it's not unheard of, is it, to get you 2 weeks?
It's an easy way to get through your surgery list.
But yeah, it was just, I thought it was interesting that kind of the fact that she
wider ramifications.
And another thing, sorry, we're probably coming to the end of the time now, but another thing I saw recently was the Imperial College London were doing a talk on race and mental health. And it's really fascinating because they had a GP on there who was black. And he was saying when someone black comes into his consultation room, there's like this relief. You can see this physical relief that, oh, I've got a black doctor. You know, they're going to understand my needs better than a white doctor would. But one of the other people on there was saying that their research, it was a researcher from the college, and she was saying that in her research with communities, because there are so few clinicians that are minority ethnic, when somebody is matched up, so if a black patient is matched up with a black psychologist, they feel they're getting a disservice because why aren't I getting a white one? Because they're better.
It's always so much more complicated than it seems, isn't it?
I know, and it just fascinated me when she said that, and I thought I could probably understand it. Probably see why we might feel that way, but
that's fascinating. There's bias all around the area. I remember a story about a complaint from I won't say which county in the West Country, but I get by against the doctor because they were Scottish. So you're not going to understand my accent was the implication.
Wow.
So Lee, we're in the last few moments. Are there any resources or services that you'd particularly like to mention or signpost people to?
Do you know what? I could list hundreds. And I think that's what's shocking for me is there is so much research around this. Yeah. So many kind of surveys, so many university research projects. But nothing changes. And I think just go onto Google and type in ethnicity and mental health, and you will just get videos and reports and surveys and all sorts. It's just loads and loads of stuff like that. And we've only scratched the surface of it in this half an hour. But yeah, it's all out there. And I think maybe the NHS, we need to be a bit braver about implementing stuff to deal with this.
And I think we need to start by acknowledging our own biases. All of us who work in the NHS is a good starting point to then be able to build from there, because I think too many of us just carry on doing what we've always done.
Of course. And I appreciate, you know, in GP land, you know, you've got that window of time with that patient, haven't you? And you need to do the best for them within those confines. So, and again, that probably brings back bias again, doesn't it? Because you have to make decisions in order to keep that session going. But no, you're right. I think taking a step back sometimes and just go, hang on, why did I just automatically react in that way? And think about that, challenge yourself. And it's uncomfortable at times, I appreciate, but I think it's important.
Thank you both so much. I can hear respect in both your voices, and respect is how we need to approach everyone, all our fellow travellers in life, in order to try and get things right. Any last word, Kate? Any last word, Lee, before we...
No, I think I've had my last word.
and I think I've said far too much already. You probably will bore me.
Well, thank you both very much. And thank you to our listeners for joining us. And everybody, go well.
Thank you.